This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Joe, welcome back. It's
Hello,
Escape Pod.
Hello, Mark. I know. Hello, everybody.
Hello, Joe. And what did you do on your 13-week break? I know that you've done some travelling.
I have. I think the best travelling I've
moving.
Done is a quick jaunt to Chile.
Right. Now, where is Chile?
That's that long, skinny country, you know, on the coast.
Capitaled by
Latin
Santiago.
America. It is, yes.
Yes.
Completely captivated by Santiago and Valparaiso. Yes, yeah. I think I could relocate.
Really? What was the most amazing thing about...
About Chile?
Well, yeah, what was your first impression? What was the crazy pants there?
I think it was the diversity, definitely the sophistication.
Mm-hmm. So good nosh?
Amazing food, whether it be, you know, casual street food to, you know, high-end molecular gastronomy, fine dining, you know, 18-course degustation, you know, from 8:30 till 2 a.m., you know, that sort of thing that you do every day.
And what was...
And the people.
The people.
The people are just, you know, they're, you know...
They have people.
You know, a bit like us, a little shy.
Yeah.
But then just so warm and friendly. And so, you know, definitely gay friendly.
Ah, excellent. You know. So the hotel you were staying in, you were also saying that there was an Australian connection there.
Yes, I did. I stayed at the Aubrey Hotel, which is a boutique hotel in Santiago, run by a Sydneysider with the most amazing team. You know, just brilliant.
Right. And he's also very connected to our community as well.
He is indeed. He and his partner, Tim. And with a bit of luck, I think we might get them on the phone in a few weeks.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And have a chat.
And say, hola.
We will. Hola.
Hola.
Yes.
Okay. Welcome back. And welcome back, everybody, to us.
What did you
I don't
do?
Think it works that way.
What did you do while I was away?
I went to Hotham. That's about as far as I got.
I like the way you say it.
To
Hotham.
Hotham.
Almost Gotham.
Nearly.
Batman.
Went from Gotham to Hotham. It was a long day. And it was beautiful to see the snow at the end of winter. So I was very grateful to have the opportunity to go up there and go for a Schlitterbahn.
Oh, an après-ski?
No, I had to drive, so there was no après-ski. But I enjoyed watching other people après-ski and then try and walk through the snow afterwards, which was...
I'm not even going to go there.
It was halaculous. So, well, good for them for having a go. Yeah, and that's about it. But if you're listening in to Joy 94.9, listening to the Escape Pod right now, let us know what you've been up to lately. We'd love to hear if you've been travelling. You can SMS us on 0427 Joy 949. Phone us at 1300 Joy 949. Beck from Beckford, she's still here. She puts in about, I think, 27 hours every Saturday. She's here and she'll be more than happy to take your call. Or you can email us on air at joy.org.au. But today we have a special guest. And if you're a tweeter, you might have seen what we've already launched out there. But we're going to let her speak for herself. Welcome very much.
Well, hello.
Oh, yes. Sorry.
Yes,
we've got
sorry.
Studio mics. I love it. Which one am I doing? I'm on the right one.
It's all right.
It's all good.
Sally, don't spoil it for everybody.
No, I'm terribly sorry. I think I actually was leaning in the wrong direction. And yes, I'm so delighted to be here.
Welcome, Sally. Now, Sally. Sally
McLean.
Tell us what your connection is to travel and the framework and why you're here today to talk to us, because it's really quite fascinating. I'm really interested and really intrigued.
Okay. Well, the framework in which travel applies to what I'm up to is actually literally and, I guess, figuratively as well. I am currently directing and producing a documentary about someone who was very important in the sporting world, particularly from the 1930s through to the 1960s. His name was Franz Stampfl. And by the name alone, you'll get that that's obviously not a, as we'd call, a straight Australian story there. It's actually covers quite a few countries. He was originally Austrian. Mm-hmm. So as a result of doing this documentary, I have travelled to Europe to do some filming. But it's also been an incredible journey of travelling through history and through time.
So with a name like Stampfl, I mean, very much so an Austrian. So
Austrian.
With a long history. So this history must go back touching, you know, one of the most pivotal moments of the 1900s.
Yeah, it's interesting. He was born in 1913. Ooh, so we okay. have his story, and he passed away in 1995. So we have that entire stretch of time that his story obviously covers. And it was pretty eventful, pretty much from word go, but particularly from the 1930s through into obviously World War II. And and into the 50s. That was a very busy time and a very eventful time for him, and he went through an awful lot. And as a result of his story, which has so many twists and turns, the name of the film is A Life Unexpected, and that's called that because of the amount of different choices that were made that landed him where he eventually ended up.
Now, I think some of our audience might be a little bit curious as to exactly what this gentleman was capable of doing, and clearly something he could do was motivate people.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you better tell us a little bit about what he actually did, what he could get, what he could get people to do that they couldn't do before.
Well, Franz came to prominence, I guess, in 1954. He was working as an athletics coach in England, and he had been coaching a group of young men from Oxford and Cambridge as a coach who were attempting to break a record that everyone thought was impossible to break, and that was the 4-minute mile. And so
should we be hearing some Vangelis in the background?
You maybe should be hearing some of that, because actually Harold Abrahams was also involved in Franz's career. He's the man who gave Franz his first coaching job in England, which of course Chariots of Fire was about. And then, yes, he met Chris Brasher and Chris Chataway and was coaching with them. And they said to him, we'd like to bring our friend Roger Bannister along. And he said, of course, bring him along to coaching. And so Franz became the man who coached Roger Bannister to break the 4-minute mile on the 6th of May, 1954. And basically achieved something no one thought could be done.
Where did Roger hail from?
Roger was actually an Oxford student at the time studying medicine. And he was originally from London. And so he was, again, it was that era where Roger was studying full time and he was taking his exams and doing his prac and at the same time coaching. But he had also been an Olympian prior. He was an Olympian in 1952, disappointed with his performance and really felt that maybe what he needed to focus on was actually breaking the 4-minute mile, because he was a miler. And that was something that he felt he could do, but he couldn't quite get there. Then he met Franz, and Franz provided that inspiration and additional training, and lo and behold, he broke the record.
So this is the beginning of Franz's story, or did you research before
that? No, Franz's
that?
Story definitely started, Franz was originally an artist. He was actually a painter, and that's what he intended to be.
He didn't go to art school with Hitler, did he?
No. No, we kind of, it's an interesting
story
though.
Because Hitler was an artist.
He was.
And look what happens when you reject an artist.
That's exactly correct. It's interesting actually, because they were both Austrian and both artists and didn't end up becoming artists as their full-time job. But no, apart from that, that's where the similarity completely ends.
But this story takes place in Austria. This story takes place in the UK. Where else did it take you so that we can sort of flesh out more details as we go
through? We ended up in, the story also happens in Dublin, in Ireland. It also happens in Canada. It also happens in the USA.
It's a big story.
Oh, yes. And it also very much happens here in Australia. So there is a very strong Australian connection as well.
Huh.
So, yes, okay. it's in a quite... And there are... Ultimately, he coached, we've estimated, over 22,000 people around the world.
Wow.
At all levels of athletics. So from casual joggers right the way through to Olympic athletes. And that was over 17 countries. So
that's France. Now, let's talk about you. You're a documentary maker. And you got... bitten by the Franz bug at some stage, obviously, because you're intrigued by this person's story.
Yes.
But you make documentaries for a living.
And no, I don't. Not
oh,
me.
You
I
don't?
No, I don't necessarily. Well, I don't make documentaries. This one is my living at the moment, yes. No, I don't necessarily make documentaries for a living. I do make films for a living, but predominantly what's interesting for me, so you're correct in the sense that absolutely I'm a filmmaker. I'm actually first and foremost an actress, but got into filmmaking from working in production for places like BBC and Endemol here and a few other companies.
Because Big Brother?
Yes, I
for
was.
For your sins? Were you really?
I was involved in the Melbourne auditions for that.
Okay.
So yes, I was there for my sins. But it was it definitely, from an actor's perspective, you're a storyteller.
Mm.
As a filmmaker, you are also a storyteller. And for me, it became more about the stories just became so intriguing and there were stories I wanted to tell. And in this case, I've done mainly drama in the past and comedy. And that's really obviously, again, tied back to my acting work. But for this, I'd worked in documentaries at BBC. And this particular story was a personal connection because my mother was one of France's first Australian squad of Olympians in 1955.
Ah, okay.
And that's how I know the story. And so I became more and more intrigued as I met all the other Olympians of that era and obviously heard her stories. And yeah, so there suddenly someone said, I said, oh, you know, someone should make a film about this man. And there's a group of 56 Olympians going, well, okay, off you go.
And then you went, oh, before. But this is around the world.
Yeah, then I realised how big the story was, but by then it was too late to turn back. So we're in the midst of it.
Goodness. So how on earth do you get something that is such an enormous scope funded?
Well, at this point, it's all been funded through donations from the public and one private investor. And that's how the money's come in to enable us to do this.
This is a big undertaking. We'll talk about this more through the hour. And we've got a couple of messages from our fabulous sponsors. And on that, it's not the membership drive anymore, but we still love a donation. We are free to air, but it's not free to go to air. It does take a lot of volunteers.
Christmas
is coming.
It's like 11 weeks away.
I know.
Filler.
Hanukkah is coming. We've got a lot of different things. We've just had Eid. So there's lots of reasons to give. And Joy is one of those places you can give to. You can go to our website, joy.org.au. You can become a member, a financial member. We'd love to see you. And then you can qualify for the prizes and giveaways and many, many other things. Also, we would like to invite you to consider taking the Taste of Radio course. And that's where Joe and I got involved with being on air at Joy.
It was, absolutely. Couldn't speak more highly of it.
Well, yeah. We would speak as highly as we possibly can. From Level 9 at 225 Bourke Street, you're on Joy 94.9.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Sally, I'm imagining that getting close to some of the people who are very important in this documentary, even though they were within their own right extremely competitive and you know, stars of their chosen athletics field, must have been a little bit easier than perhaps today to get closer to sporting celebrities.
Yeah, in a way, I think it probably was. I mean, of course, when Franz was first here in Australia, which was 55 that he first arrived, all sport on a professional level, pretty much, particularly at an Olympic level, was amateur. So nobody was paid. And if you were paid, you lost your amateur status and therefore you lost your chance to be in the Olympics. So people were very careful not to take any kind of sponsorship or gifts or whatever else to a certain value because they wanted to be able to compete at that level. I guess as a result of that, many people, none of them were paid. Therefore, the story that I was saying before in the break about, you know, people who were Olympians, they never thought to cash in on that in any way. They never thought anyone was that interested, to be honest. It was something they did. And so for us to get closer to them, the reason it was easier rather than the fact that they were amateur was because my mother was the contact for me to them. And of course, that's because she herself was one of Franz's original squad.
So how did you reach out to Franz? She was still in contact with him because he seemed to globetrot, this guy who's moving around a fair bit.
He did globetrot. Franz passed away in 95 when Mum first, it was 55 when she first heard that he had landed in Australia. She was actually at high school in her final year. Mm. She was 17 and she held all the school records. And what she wanted to do was improve her throwing. She was a thrower. She was a shot put, javelin and discus thrower. She wanted to improve all of her throws so that she would have her school record stand for a really long time after she left school. That was her ambition.
Competitive streak on
Mum.
She's
very competitive. She was. She still is to a degree. So she saw this advertised, I think it was in the Argus newspaper, that he was coming to schoolgirl clinic to see what the young talent was like. And so she begged her parents to take her up to Olympic Park, and they did. And that's where she participated in that clinic. And at the end of the clinic, Franz came up to my grandfather and to my mom and said to my grandfather, your daughter is extremely talented as a thrower. And then he turned to mum and said, how would you like to be a world champion? And mum just went, okay, as you would. So that's how it started. He then said, okay, well, in that case, you will need to be here at training every night after school. You will be doing 2 hours training a day.
And how did Franz get to Melbourne?
He was actually brought out by the University of Melbourne and Sir Frank Beaurepaire. They were the two people.
And how did Sir Frank Beaurepaire find Franz?
Well, it was actually Bill Rawlinson was a professor at Melbourne University at the time, and he'd met France during World War II because this was the second time that France had been out here to Australia in the 50s. He'd been here before, and he met Bill Rawlinson. And so Bill actually saw him throwing a javelin, and Bill himself was an athlete. So I guess, I'd probably need to quantify that. Essentially, Franz was brought out here in 1940 as a De Niro boy. And the De Niro boys were the boys that were shipped out, men and boys who were shipped out from England, who were enemy aliens during the war. Churchill basically said, reportedly, allegedly, collar the lot, which meant to grab everybody of Austrian, German and Italian descent and get them out of the country, because they were worried about fifth columnists and spies and other people.
Right, right. So by getting out of the country, they mean getting out of England.
Literally get them out of England. So they were put on ships and they were taken to Canada and Australia and other countries within the Commonwealth.
Where the spiders are.
Where the spiders are, exactly, and the snakes. So initially he was put, the story goes...
And igloos.
And igloos. Yes. Oh, well, in certain places there probably were. But yeah, and I think New Zealand actually took people as well. But they put him on initially a ship called the Arandora Star. This is the story, and which was going to Canada. It got torpedoed an hour out of Liverpool by the Germans because they forgot to put a red cross symbol on it, whether that was deliberate or
so a bit of an
accidental.
Own goal by the Germans.
Yes. So the Germans ended up torpedoing their own people. But of course, the ship sank and they lost half of the internees on that ship. And Franz apparently survived that. In the water 9 hours in the Atlantic, very, very cold. Was rescued, taken back to Liverpool, and I think it was 3 days later put on the De Niro and then shipped out to Australia. And that
must have been thrilled about getting another boat after that.
I know, exactly. They were torpedoed on the De Niro as well, but the torpedo didn't explode. They were very lucky.
So it just went clunk.
It just clunk. Well, it went into the ship apparently, but not in a dangerous area of the hull. And so actually it made the trip with an unexploded torpedo. Which just does. Anyway, they did that. I don't know. I think they must have got down there and diffused it. But yeah, it luckily didn't explode. But that could have been twice. But he avoided that. But he got here after an absolutely dreadful journey. It was known as the last convict ship that came out to Australia. They were treated terribly. They were beaten. They had all their possessions taken from them. And they put Nazis in with non-Nazis and Jewish people. I mean, it was just a ludicrous scenario. The Brits handled that incredibly badly, to the point where three of the British officers were court-martialed 2 months after the ship made land here in Australia. So during a wartime, for officers to be court-martialed is extraordinary. The Australians took one look at them when they landed and were horrified and got them off the boats and gave them food, and all of them were suffering scurvy and it was terrible. But anyway, they
sunshine got... Sunshine and oranges.
Totally sunshine and oranges. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the war, obviously, there were so many stories of people being shipped out like this from different places and the terrible things that happened. But once they got here, they actually... were put in two different
internment camps. Isn't it funny? We used to be able to take refugees.
Yes, we did. And that's
how short our memory.
Exactly. Exactly. Because the story of the De Niro boys is that they were put in two internment camps, Hay and Tatura. They were held. Most of them were released around about 1942 when they realised that many of them weren't threats. And they needed more people, funnily enough, for the Australian Army because we were running out of men. So they said...
Being shot and killed.
It was a war of attrition.
Totally a war of attrition. So they said to them, okay, well, you can either, you know, go back to England, which I'm sure nobody wanted to get back on a boat with the activity that was still going on, or you can stay here and join the army. So actually most of the De Niro, well, quite a few of them joined the army and stayed. A lot of them were on home duties. I don't believe they saw action. Some of them might have, but majority were on home duties. But yeah, they joined the army. And at the end of the war, many of them stayed. And they have contributed hugely, particularly to Melbourne and Sydney's culture as a result of staying. And they are all refugees.
Oh, it's so true. I mean, if you pop down to Lygon Street on a Saturday morning, you'll run into some of those gentlemen.
You will, yes.
You know, and they've maintained their links to places even like Pakapanyo. And it's these guys who were immigrants, forced immigrants.
That's it.
And they actually keep so much of the RSL spirit alive, and they contribute constantly.
Yes, absolutely.
To that community. It's quite extraordinary. You just often wonder about the mental fortitude as to how someone could actually turn something that is just, you know, such a negative into a positive.
You've been shoved into another country. Back
clearly,
then, across the other side of the world, in a country that had a population, I think at the time, of 5 million or something puny like that, spread over a very large island.
And, and France, obviously, you know, had this extraordinary ability to not only do that for himself, but to be able to communicate that to many, many other people.
He definitely used his wartime experience as, again, another way to help motivate people. Mm. Because he also understood what it looked like to be that desolate and that alone.
Wretched,
exactly. I mean, I've talked to some of the De Niro boys already, and they've all said it wasn't awful, but they've also said that it was an experience they wouldn't have missed.
Very interesting. Okay, so now we understand the person we're talking about, the time frame that he was dealing in. We're going to talk about, are you bonkers after a bit of a break? You've had to travel around the world. You've got some logistics and you must be throwing money at a whole lot of problems on the way to get things done.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Our guest today is Sally McLean. Sally has bit off the rather unusually burdensome challenge of making a documentary that spans how many countries?
Well, at this point, the documentary itself will only be covering about six.
Six, so, okay. Yeah. So let's talk. We understand why. Let's just give our praises in case people have just tuned in. You've identified a rather brilliant individual that contributed to global sporting culture by...
by being one of the most brilliant athletics coaches that I think we've seen, to be honest. And he coached Roger Bannister to break the four-minute mile, which is what everyone knows him for.
And Roger Bannister was also the $6 million man, wasn't he?
He might have been. That would be hilarious to see him do that. That would be very funny.
Maybe I'm thinking of Bruce Bannister.
Oh, you might be thinking of Bruce Bannister.
Oh, no, that's the Hulk. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. Yep.
Sorry. Thank God the gamers are gone. Otherwise, I'd be in strife. So he coached someone to do an amazing thing. He grew up through the war. He was spat out by the British into Australia at a time where it probably was less desirable than would be considered today. You know, he was... torpedoed.
Yes, he was torpedoed. He was interned into an internment camp.
And
he,
much like the Confucian curse, may you have an interesting life, he did so.
Indeed.
And so you are now putting this to film.
I am. Mm. I am.
So what are the logistics? How do you go about going global? And what was this process? Do you have a Google Calendar that you share with other people?
Now, that's a really good idea. Yeah. No, we don't actually do that. Well, at this point, I mean, I'm not luckily the only person pulling this together. My co-producer is the fabulous Ben Steele, who is working crazily at the moment to pull this together with me. We have our executive producer, Bobby Galinsky. So there's three of us there. My mother, bless, who had not revealed that she was an Olympian until I was 15, which is all the other reason, I think, why France suddenly became so important, because at that age, when you learn about this whole other life of a parent, everybody involved in that becomes interesting. So she's been brought on board as a co-producer for her sins.
So has that changed your relationship with your mum?
Well, it's interesting. No, not really. It's interesting. My mum and I have always got along incredibly well, which I've been very, very lucky and grateful that's been the case. We've had our moments, but generally we kind of very similar people, I think. And yes, there are moments when I'll say, no, mum, don't do that. But it's interesting because she's used to, and she'll be the same with me, but she's used to working... She ran a performing arts company when I was a kid, which I begged to be a member of and she wouldn't let me do that until I was 10 because that was the rules. And so we've always managed to have a professional relationship and a personal one.
Do you think she actually acquired that ability from her training with Franz?
I think it is something that, yes, I do think that was probably an influence because he would work obviously with his athletes on that professional level, but he was also someone who liked to socialise and to talk. And actually, to be honest, some of his coaching would take place in those less formalised sessions where he would share stories and talk about their lives and his life and that sort of thing. So yes, she did learn to do that differentiation between the two, but I think that's also intrinsically just her. It's through his influence and through other influences that she'd had through school, etc. But yes, she very much learned how to do that, and I think pass that on to me, so it hasn't been so dreadful, which is good. People do say that, how do you guys cope, what's Christmas like? Yeah, it's like, no, actually Christmas is great. And if it wasn't for mum, I mean, he coached over 300 Olympians, so there's a lot of people around the world that he coached. Because of mum, obviously people are more prepared to talk to us because she herself was coached by him and an Olympian. So I'm very grateful that she's prepared to take on that burden for us and help us out there.
Okay, so just organisationally, getting around the world, what are things like when you lob up in Austria, the UK? I'm assuming because of the nature of the filming, it's not a huge crew and your call sheet is probably not an arm's length long, but you must have some makeup, you must have some sound guys.
Well, it's interesting actually because...
So what are your logistics?
What are our logistics
and how do you do it? Do you travel as a team or do you source local talent when you... when you arrive somewhere?
We actually do a mix of both. What I will always take my director of photography with me wherever I go, because there is that thing of continuity of look. And if we could do it, my gaffer as well, only she may not be. She's gone off to become an environmental scientist, which I love that she's doing, but I'm like, no, not till we
finish. I'm sure Tony Abbott will have her fired soon.
Yeah, well, yes, I know, exactly. That decision was made prior to this whole, don't even start me on that. But I keep trying to borrow her in her holidays. But yes, I prefer to take that team because that dictates the look of the project and it's very important to get that right. So generally we do that and then we will end up, particularly for our European trip, which essentially happened because we got a phone call from one of our interviewees to say, I've just been diagnosed with cancer and I will not live longer than 5 months. And if you want to get me on camera, you've got to come now, which was a panic. So we had to raise money in a month. Then we got a call from another one of our interviewees in Austria saying almost exactly the same thing, which was horrendous. I mean, a lot of these...
Okay, so you're dealing with people who are aging...
Yeah, they're 75 plus, most of them.
Right, so you've got to be responsive to those things. And how do you manage with the language? Because I would imagine that people in their... septuagenarians in Austria would... not necessarily have English language skills like a young Austrian may?
No, it's interesting actually because it was Franz's younger brother that we interviewed and he was very unwell and we knew that he was quite a robust character, but he had been told that he probably wouldn't live much longer. So we raced over there to interview Otto and he was a lovely man, but obviously, as you say, there was the language issue. So we actually had two people with us. One was our on-set photographer and the other was our locations guy, and the other turned out to be Franz's niece, who all spoke English and German, and they all took turns translating, because we had five interviews in Austria, all of them in German. Mm. So we actually had all these people doubling as translators for us. It was a very challenging interview day, I have to say, for that reason.
Not in language, but what about cultural and sort of regulatory kind of, I know, get a bit boring and legalistic, but at the border, do the Austrians go, Vaya, you're filming everything here?
They were actually the most welcoming.
Are you here for the sound of the music?
No, they were the most welcoming people you could ever want. I was ringing.
So you didn't meet Jörg Haider?
No, we didn't. No, I mean, I actually adored our locations guy. He was fantastic, Ernst, and he was always on the phone. It was beautiful. He was always on the phone talking to somebody, going "ciao ciao" at the end of every call. I mean, he was like a little piece of Hollywood in Austria. It was just extraordinary in Vienna. They were really welcoming. They opened their doors. They said, don't worry about permits. We're happy for you just to come as long as we know where you are. Our locations guy was part of the official structure of the film industry there. So because Ernst was on board, they were like, it's totally fine. He got us the venue for free. So we shot at the Imperial Hotel in Vienna, which is extraordinary for nothing, which is
Is that
amazing.
What's on your website for the...
Yes.
Yeah, okay, that room
is incredibly ornate.
Yeah, you can tell the gaze of been around for a long time.
Absolutely. It was a beautiful, just stunning room. I loved being in there. And it was that thing of I wasn't sure if I could touch anything because it was all gold leaf and beautiful. But it's a stunning hotel. Mm. Funnily enough, as we found out filming that day, that was the hotel Franz used to stay in when he went back to Vienna.
Now, how are people's memories though, Sally? Because you, as you mentioned, you are talking to people who are a little bit older and you can't talk to Franz, so you're needing to rely on everybody else's memory and recollection. How difficult is that as a documentary maker?
It's a very interesting conundrum in some cases, because you will have, there's one interviewer I'm thinking of right now who I've heard the same story now told about five different ways. So it's like, okay, split the difference.
Yes, you've got which to kind version of the
out,
truth?
Yeah, work out which is which. And that's where corroboration needs to come in.
Never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
And I do think that's part of what's happening there. But it is trying to then corroborate the information. So you need to go through all the archives of all the newspapers at the time. You need to talk to others who may have been there. I mean, that's sort of how you deal with that problem. But on the whole, I have to say, many of them are incredibly sharp and very together and have very clear memories. One of our interviewees, bless her, I love that she did this. She was a younger one, but she brought in all of her training notes. She's got exercise books of notes after notes after notes that she noted, and they all had to do this, but many of them have thrown them away, but she kept it. So it's all photographs of her training and her notes of the training sessions. And I was just looking at it going...
Through which era?
Wow, that's through the late 1970s into the 80s.
Okay.
An extraordinary amount of work that was going on.
And how has training changed today? When you look at at those kinds of archive materials, you know, what happens with athletes today in their training?
It's really interesting. Franz's great gift, as well as being a great inspirator, was that he also tailored every training program to the individual athlete. So there was no one-size-fits-all for training. He would look at the athletes, he'd get to know who they were, he'd work out what they needed motivationally, he would then also work out what they needed physically, and that was what made him so good as a coach.
Interesting.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Sally, I have to ask, you've obviously been compiling the documentary for a long time. Now, how many months has it been?
Oh, we're talking years.
Yes. Yeah. Come on.
And I'm not going to divulge.
All right. So have you had a holiday? Have you taken a break? In all of this travel where you've been some great locations, have you actually had a chance to do any, you know, R&R yourself?
Or? Not really, no. No, mainly because when we've been filming and we've now got a trip coming up the east coast of Australia, and then there's another one to the US and Canada. That may be a bit easier because there hopefully will be two producers present, but generally I'm producer, production manager, line producer and the interviewer. So you coordinate.
And that's just to keep costs to a minimum.
Totally, absolutely, yeah. So it's three crew that will travel usually. We're going to hopefully expand that now, but yeah. Unfortunately in previous travels, not really. We got one day in Vienna, where we literally got almost frog marched all the way around the city just so they could say we'd seen it. And they were the guys that were the photographer, actually, bless him, and his friends. It's like, we've got to show you Vienna. So I've got a really kaleidoscope picture of Vienna as a result. Amazing.
Beautiful blur.
Oh, my gosh. Mm. Absolutely. I mean, gold
leaf. What was your first impression? Yeah, they love a bit of gold leaf.
They love it. Yeah.
Let them eat Zachertorte. Oh. So what was your first impression of Vienna that was outside of the framework of why you were there for filming, apart from being frog marched around?
I joke about that, but it really felt like it. You know, it was that thing of suddenly standing in the third church in a row and just suddenly realising where I was.
Yeah, it's an ABC tourist, another bloody church, another bloody castle.
Yeah, it was funny, you know. It was that thing of going, but my goodness, I mean, it was beautifully done and the art was amazing. And they'd taken me in there to show me a frieze, an actual, it was a etching on the wall of some description that was actually medieval. So that was actually the plainest thing in the room, but that's what they wanted to show me. But I just remember turning around looking at this incredible altar and the amazing cathedral ceilings and just going, I'm in Vienna. It's that horrendous sort of thing. Oh, my goodness, I've been travelling for nearly 2 weeks and I've just realised that I'm actually in Europe, you know. So,
well, that's the thing with travelling for work, right?
Oh, absolutely. So that was a beautiful moment, though, because it felt like I suddenly took a very deep breath and just went, oh, wow, okay, just make the most of this day, because I knew that we had that time, we'd scheduled it. And I was like, you know what, I'm just going to be a tourist for today.
Yep.
So that was beautiful. So I loved that. Found some beautiful little restaurants. I'm a celiac. Found gluten-free schnitzel. Was so excited. It was amazing. Mm. Went to the cafe, the central cafe.
All right.
Did all that sort of touristy stuff. But it was just that, yeah, realizing you're in a totally different culture and getting to experience a little bit of that, a tiny piece of that was extraordinary, and I loved it. And that was the bonus of being able to film overseas, is that you can get these little glimpses of another world.
And what does North America hold in terms of your itinerary? Where will you be taking the camera to?
At this point, it is scheduled to be a Los Angeles, possibly a trip through New York, and then we go straight into Toronto and across Winnipeg, Vancouver.
And you're not doing this in the middle of winter, are you?
No, we're trying to avoid it. But to be honest, the way the scheduling is going, we keep going, oh, no, it's going to be February, isn't it? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, all the Canadians are saying to us, please don't come or you'll freeze to death. You'll never get anything done. The cameras won't work, you know, all that stuff.
It just literally gets that cold.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. They said, don't expect to film outside if you're coming in that time of the year. So, yeah, we've got to look at that. But that is likely to be the trip at this point. And, again, that's just about raising money to be able to do it.
Yeah, of course.
So do you have a launch date in mind? I mean, or is there a film festival that you're aiming to be able to release this?
No, we're in conversation at the moment. We are hoping at this point in time it's scheduled to be completed mid next year, so mid 2015. But again, it just comes down to where the money's coming from. And so we're aiming to do that. We keep working towards that. That's where all the conversations are. And
are you crowdsourcing funding?
We were looking at doing that, but because we're raising money through the Documentary Australia Foundation through donations, which enables people to get a tax deduction if they donate.
Right.
So we found to be quite successful doing that. So we've kind of kept that rolling on. But we're also talking to, obviously, people that are stakeholders in the story and looking at gifts in kind and contra and all of that stuff, because that's the other way to obviously bring the whole project together.
Yeah.
It means you are working on about five different planes of focus at once, right. But, you know, that's just the nature of independent filmmaking, particularly in this country. So,
yeah,
I'm not alone. I know plenty of others that are trying to do the same thing.
Yeah, of course, of course.
Yeah, yeah. But it is something that... we know we'll get done. It will get done one way or the other. It's just a matter of when.
And so, have you been able to stretch yourself, you know, to actually take on any other projects during this time, or has this just been 100% your focus?
I've taken on acting gigs in the interim because I've done a couple of gigs for Channel 10. I've done...
So anything, you know, people will have seen you in recently?
No, it's yet to be released, so I'm not allowed to talk about it.
Oh, no, it's embargoed.
It's embargoed at this point. So just done a couple of guest roles there, did a couple of guest roles. I did a recurring guest role for ABC's Worst Year of My Life again, which is a kids' series playing the librarian teacher, Miss Giddens. I take on whatever acting roles obviously come up and throw my hat in the ring for that, because that's what keeps me a bit sane, I think, in the process.
So you're saying auditions keep you sane?
Yeah, I know. I'm one of those weird actors who actually doesn't mind the audition process, but that's probably because I've worked on the other side of the table as well. I've worked in casting. So once that happens, it demystifies the whole process. So I just, you know, no problem doing it.
Fascinating life. Very interesting. We want to hear about how bonkers you are and what you're going to be doing next.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Sally,
thank you very much for coming in and talking about your fascinating doco and the process it takes to get it together and travelling around the world and globetrotting. Today on International Coming Out Day, tell us about your website.
Okay. I love that segue. Okay, so the website. Well, if anyone wants to know more about the documentary, they can go along to www.alifeunexpected.com. And they will see the trailer that we've currently cut together from our interviews with Roger Bannister and Chris Chataway and John Landy and Ralph DeBell and several other athletes and people. And they can find out more about the project, who we are, what we're doing, what the plans are, all that stuff.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. So thank you very much for coming in. So, Jo, are you going to do much for the rest of the day apart from enjoy cocktail hour, slightly belated?
No, it's dog walking time. I'm sorry to say it. I know it sounds banal, but before the little black dress goes on, I must take Shimei for her walk.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.